good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan, and joining me in studio tonight I have Professor Mary Horgan, President of the Royal College of Physicians of Ireland and Consultant in Infectious Diseases, Fergus O'Dowd, Fine Gael TD for Louth, Jack Chambers, Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin West, Rory O'Murchu, Sinn Féin TD for Louth, and Justine McCarthy, Senior Journalist with the Sunday Times Ireland. Now, we want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte, hashtag RTELD. Now, there's been another jump in the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases this evening. Here's Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Houlihan speaking at the Daily Department of Health briefing this evening.
We have 10 new cases diagnosed of COVID-19 in Ireland today. Two of these are healthcare workers, one a male from the south, one a female from the east. Three of them are males from the south associated with travel. Two of them are contacts of confirmed cases in the west, one a female and one a male. Another is a close contact of a case, a female from the south. And then we have a male and a female, each from the east, associated with travel from Italy.
And that was Dr. Tony Houlihan. Meanwhile, as Italy extends its emergency measures nationwide, there's also been a change to the travel advisory issued by the Department of Foreign Affairs. Here's Simon Coveney speaking earlier today.
Up until yesterday, our travel advice was that nobody should travel to the northern regions of Italy unless it was absolutely essential. And now that is extended to the country as a whole. So, I mean, it really is totally unprecedented that you'd have a Minister for Foreign Affairs advising Irish citizens not to travel to a large EU member state. But that is the advice this morning.
And that was Simon Coveney talking about the unprecedented situation we are now finding ourselves in. And I do want to talk to Professor Bridget Laffin about that situation in Italy in a moment. But first, I want to turn to another professor, Professor Mary Horgan, because Mary, you are one of the most experienced clinicians in the country when it comes to battling viruses. Your clinics, you normally hold clinics in CUH and Cork University Hospital.
Yeah, Cork University Hospital. So I've been an infectious disease consultant for the past 30 years. So I've seen a lot in those three decades. Old, new, things that have been cured, things that are totally controllable. So a lot of experience in the field.
Now, you've cancelled your clinics in Cork. What's happening in CUH at the moment? Because, of course, that they were some of our earliest confirmed cases.
Yeah, so down CUH at the moment, there are a number of cases that are being managed by my colleagues down there, in particular Dr. Karina Sadlier. What is happening from clinic point of view is essential services are continuing. Those patients that require treatment, for instance, with HIV and their medications, we're dispensing those and really focusing on people who need absolutely essential services. That's really been managed by the hospital administration along with frontline staff who are working really hard, not only to care for the patients, but to come up with protocols to ensure that people within the hospital are protected, both staff, but particularly vulnerable patients.
Yeah, and this is what we heard from Italy, that, and of course, we're all looking at Italy now and thinking, are we just a few weeks on from where Italy were, say, towards the end of February? And they talked about clearing out their hospitals in preparation for what they knew was inevitably going to come. Is that happening in our hospitals, do you know?
I wouldn't say it's clearing out. I think people aren't coming into hospital. You see the trolley figures have gone way down. So people are, and in particular my colleagues out in the community in general practice who are managing a huge amount of extra work out in the community to avoid hospital admissions. So that's part of the tactic. I personally think that this is an issue where Team Ireland needs to get behind it. And by what I mean by Team Ireland, I mean not only the healthcare professions, politicians across all parties, but the public. While the illness when it occurs is mild in most people, it isn't in a number of people, and there is an onus on us as a society to protect the vulnerable in our society, and none of us here around the table hasn't somebody who's elderly, who's got a friend who's got on cancer chemotherapy, a relative both in your immediate family or extended family. So this is, you know, we get behind our team, if it's a rugby team or Team Ireland or a soccer team. This is a national issue that requires everybody to have societal responsibility to ensure that we protect those that are vulnerable to this infection.
Okay, as you say, you have seen and treated and dealt with other viruses that bubbled up out of nowhere, like SARS, like MERS. Why is this different? What is the nature of this that has gotten us to this unprecedented situation so quickly?
Yeah, so it's in the same family as SARS. It's called SARS-CoV-2. What's different about it? There's always subtle differences between viruses. There is more people that have a low level of infection, and when that happens, often they can go around not knowing they have it and then spread it on to other people. That didn't particularly happen with SARS. With SARS, people got sick very quickly. Some people recovered, other people died. And for a virus to be successful, it does exactly that. It's a low, so it can be low grade, easily transmitted without people knowing it. And the nature of infectious diseases, they're quite different from any other disease that humans have. They're the only thing that are transmitted from one human to the other. And what's predictable about infectious diseases is that they're unpredictable.
And the thing about a virus is, it's, if you want to give it a life of its own, its survival is to find new hosts constantly.
Absolutely. They're very clever. They adapt to environments and they look for a host that suits them. The good thing about infectious diseases is that science and research has been very successful at either curing or treating in particular viral infections. We've had it with hepatitis C, which is now curable. That was never even that wasn't even thought of, given that it's only around since the 1980s. HIV, we know there's a pandemic. Science and research and funding into that area has produced treatments that are easy for people to take and that people can live a normal life with them. So if I'm, you know, and I am a very optimistic person, so I have no doubt that with the funding that's been put into this, the research into areas of vaccine and medications.
And of course, we're hearing today that there's another big push for funding to go into this from a EU level.
Absolutely. That's what fixes infectious diseases.
But with the best will in the world and with the best scientists in the world on the case, we're still going to be a considerable way off. Vaccine.
You know, usually a vaccine will take, you know, 1 to 2 years to make sure that it's safe, first of all, and that it works. The phase one of development are due to be underway this month. But realistically, it'll be 1 to 2 years before one is available. And that is our great hope.
That's our great hope. But our great fear and our big concern right now is this thing is coming at us. If the pattern is any way connected to what's happened in other countries, and particularly, of course, Italy is the big, you know, terrifying story. We're hearing from Italy that 10% of the people who are contracting it there are requiring intensive care treatment. And then we're hearing huge numbers here from the modelling that's being done in terms of perhaps up to half the population, even more, coming down with some level of it. But those figures are terrifying, aren't they, in the context of our health service?
Well, people give out about our health service, but we still have a very high life expectancy and low maternal mortality rate in this country. And I think people need to be reminded of that, that people on the front line really work hard to deliver good service. I suppose if you're looking at the research, and this is a very new infection, it's really only 3 months old. And what we absolutely have to do is closely monitor what's going on, what the outcomes are. And we know from evidence, the one thing that does work is social distancing. We know it's worked in China, and now we've evidence that it's working in South Korea. And that, along with what I spoke about earlier, people's awareness of how infection control works and how not to spread it, are the things that have worked so far. So, you know, when obviously social gathering, when it came to St. Patrick's Day parade, was cancelled, and I believe that was the right call. I think there's a balance about how you, when you potentially could curtail further social gatherings, the economic impact of it, the infrastructure, it needs to be balanced when you would do it and when is the right time to do it, so that it's not at a tipping point where we could see more people sicker within the country. But you know, our colleagues in the Department of Health are monitoring this very closely. You know that by the daily press conferences they have, and they are linking in with all with the frontline staff also.
Now, I don't know if people saw, there was a consultant on the Claire Bourne show last night who expressed a lot of concern that we weren't moving fast enough, that we should have been closing down, or talking about the kind of people we were letting into the country from hot zones and moving to basically bring in more restrictive measures more quickly. In your view, you know, with your experience, do you think we're handling it proportionately?
I think we're handling based on the numbers that we've had so far. One of the issues is that if you intervene too quickly and put in restrictions too quickly, that people get fatigue from it and they become complacent a few weeks later, and then you may have a bigger issue. So it is a fine balance between when you extend social distancing, and that comes in many forms, versus monitoring the situation. And I know from my interaction with the department that this is being really closely monitored.
Yeah, and I'm just seeing now, and I'm sure you're aware of this if you've listened to any media over the last few days in particular, we're getting a lot of texts in here saying, why were we still welcoming Italians last weekend? It's inarguable this should have been stopped like the Austrians are now doing. That's from Dennis in Cork. Why were international flights not shut down from the get-go, says Seamus in Galway. To adequately deal with potential effects, the government should allow... Oh, this is the one about the private medical facilities. I'll ask you about that. And then there's the issue of Cheltenham. A lot of people surprised that Cheltenham went ahead, and now concerned that we're going to have thousands of people coming back from Cheltenham. Should we be concerned?
Well, it is a big gathering. We have stopped gatherings here. So, I'm not a policymaker, but I'm saying that it's another large gathering. I think, you know, stopping people last weekend, that's in the past. What we need to be dealing with is from now on and making decisions about what is right for the population.
OK, well, stay with us there, because I want to go to Professor Bridget Laffin. Bridget, of course, Director of the Robert Schuman Centre for Advanced Studies at the European University Institute in Florence. Bridget, you're joining us on the line as you were in Florence just under 2 weeks ago, and we're being cautious and abiding by social distancing guidelines. but we can tell the nation you're feeling very well anyway.
Oh, absolutely. I left Italy just under 2 weeks ago. And at that stage, Florence, I think, had two cases. And I don't live in the city. So I think I'm OK. But I think what listening to your discussion so far, I think I can't emphasize enough the speed with which things changed in Italy. It was clearly circulating in January, and then by about the 21st of February, there were 20 cases, and they were very concentrated. But as we know, it really did spread in Lombardy, Veneto, in the north, in the north of the country. And now the government has taken very extreme measures to basically try to close Italy down. And they're doing it for two reasons. One, that the Italian health system from Rome north is excellent. it Lombardy, where the concentration is, has an outstanding health system. The real worry is if it goes into southern Italy, that the capacity isn't there to handle it, and the human cost would be even higher than it already is. And then the other reason is that it has proven quite difficult to get. Italians are very tactile, they're very sociable, they like their social habits, they go into the cafes in the morning, stand around talking for their coffee, lunchtime, etc. And it has been difficult to introduce social distancing.
Bridget, you say there that, because I mean, people might have this idea that Italy mightn't be, you know, might be slightly chaotic politically at times, but and or maybe are not surprised that the health care system in the north of Italy is struggling and overwhelmed, as we're hearing with this. But what you're saying is that actually, before this crisis hit, the health system was actually very good in northern Italy.
I have had engagement with the Tuscan health system, and it is outstanding. Checks are done quickly. You ask for a test, it's done very quickly, etc., etc. I think there are two reasons. One, the numbers are overwhelming. The number of patients that need intensive care is overwhelming. And the other is, it's an aging society. And as we know, this is a virus that appears to hit older people much more than younger people. So there were mistakes made in Italy at the beginning, because there were concentrations of what they thought was pneumonia, which turns out to have been the virus. And so I think that immediate response, so now Ireland, we're forewarned. We know what can happen if it's allowed get out of control.
How do you think it is being handled here at the moment, Bridget?
So all I can say, I mean, I'm not a specialist, and I think it's really important to listen to medical experts, epidemiologists, and people who know how to handle these things. So I would, of all of the things that has happened, I think the fact that so many Irish have gone to Cheltenham is perhaps the most worrying, because these people will come back. There was a case in Cheltenham, and it is certainly, from the photographs I saw today, there was no social distancing in Cheltenham. So I think these are the issues. As to when, I think we will experience more closures, perhaps of our universities and schools, but I'm not in a position to judge when that should happen or how it should happen. What I can say is I've spent all day today working with online, with Skype meetings, with my staff in Florence, trying to make sure that we continue to function, but that we minimise people's travel, we minimise people's engagement. So we're all working from almost everyone is now working remotely, and I spent the day perfectly able to work remotely because I could use Skype meetings, calls, and work on my computer.
Okay, will you stay on the line? Sorry, Bridget. I just want to bring in the panel, because they're waiting. They're sitting and looking at me patiently here.
But
do stay with us, and please and take part in the conversation. Fergus O'Dowd, what's your sense of what your constituents are saying to you in terms of how they might respond to more restrictive measures?
Well, first of all, they have great belief in the medical profession and the way they're handling this. They believe that the chief medical officer and his staff are very transparent and accountable and clear in their advice that they're giving on the TV and on the radio. On the ground, people are very worried. I was in a coffee shop. I was in a pharmacy today. I was in lots of different shops in the town, and everybody's talking about it. Everybody's worried. Everybody's really concerned. Everybody is, you know, in the supermarkets, they're looking for, you know, hand sanitizers. When you watch people shopping, there's a lot more, obviously, dry goods being bought, food that can be kept in the shelf for a long time without going off. So people are genuinely worried, very concerned. And I think the point that you make about the Irish team, you know, is that everybody's signing off on the advice that we're giving. From a political perspective, I think all parties agreed that, you know, to follow, and they're all fully consulted, and people need to know that everybody's putting their best foot forward. And I think that is the reality on the ground. But the worry is, I would say, it's probably increasing rather than decreasing in terms of their, you know, about their family members and older people and people with cancer and so on.
Jack, would you agree with that?
I would. And I suppose there are particularly people who are immunocompromised or whose children might have CF, or elderly people, and their family members are very worried and are concerned about what's coming. And I suppose if you look at the trolley figures today, it's a bit like the calm before the storm. And I think, in fact, you asked your question, Fergus, I think people are up for more restrictive measures and are kind of waiting for that to happen, actually, and expecting it to happen. And I think it's likely it will happen in terms of further closures of schools. And we've seen some universities close. That's probably on the way.
Do you think there's too much of an emphasis on the proportionality of the decisions
taken? To be fair, with the exception of Mary, no one else around here is an expert in public health and epidemiology, and I think they're experts in how they manage an epidemic and how that balance has to be struck. One criticism I would have is of the EU, actually. I think there's been too much focus on the economy from an EU perspective and not public health, and how I'm surprised the EU hasn't provided more coordinated approach across all EU countries, so all EU countries are at one in terms of how they act and respond and coordinate in terms of free movement of people. We've Austria closing a certain border, we have others not doing something, we've Slovenia doing one thing and Macron criticising that. I think the EU has had quite a fragmented response that probably merits some question marks in turn and on reflection, and that I think they should be fronting up on providing a cross collective response rather than it just being about the economy, because people are scared about their lives, and that's what we should be focused on, and public health in that regard. So I think that's the one thing I'd say. It's not a criticism of politics, but I think the EU institutions have, in my view, been too slow. I mean, we heard Ursula von der Leyen just today spoke about flight slots more than she did about public health, which I think was a kind of a contradiction in terms of the message going back to the public. So that'd be one criticism I'd have. I think the European Commission and Council need to be at one on how they respond and how they restrict movement. I think there'd be a much greater public health outcome if all countries are on the one page.
Okay, I'll bring Bridget in on that in a moment. But Justine, just in relation to the general where we're at and where we should be at.
Well, I think there's a big psychological aspect to what's happening to us. Mary was talking about the responsibility that we each have, you know, to do what we can. We live in a culture that's very individualistic, and we're going to have to learn to be more community-minded. I've detected some sort of almost macho attitude, you know, that people don't want to be seen to be vulnerable. And I think we're going to have to learn to allow ourselves to be seen to be behaving in a responsible way as we go about our normal lives.
Yeah, because actually, if you look at social media, it kind of breaks down to the this is terrifying and we're not doing enough and we should be closing our borders, to the quite a big cohort saying the media are outrageous, they're hyping this up, this is just another flu. So there is definitely a divide in terms of how people are dealing with
it. And I think some of that is driven by fear. Fear of the unknown, and the instinct is to deny what's happening. So I think it's a terribly fine line that the authorities have to walk between not generating panic and hysteria and, on the other hand, not generating apathy and complacency. And we have seen hints of that sort of selfish behaviour that I think is human nature. You know, people going out and stocking up on dry goods and sanitizer and toilet paper. And some people who are in the very vulnerable cohort are going in shops and they can't buy soap or sanitizer. Yeah. So I think we are going to have to adjust our behaviour and our attitude.
And you think that maybe I'll put this one to you, Rory, that what the government and our public health doctors have been trying to do is kind of bring us to a place over the last week or so where we will accept social distancing restrictions that we might not have accepted a week and a half ago.
Completely. I believe initially you would have had a greater amount of people who would have said, don't worry about it, it is being overhyped. Whereas in the last while, I've seen it even when you go in and you meet people, you see, you know, that they have hand sanitizers, particularly in, like, you know, you're dealing with particular issues with people who would fall into that vulnerable situation. And it is a case of you then have to become aware of it. And I've seen this happening with many groupings I've met. And here, like, as I say, it is a change for all of us that you have to take into account the people you're going to visit. I've even seen, as I say, instances where, because you talked about obviously being quite selfish and all the rest of it, but there's probably an element of community-minded people and people who are very family-orientated, who are making a point of visiting their elderly parents in nursing homes and everything, and their initial difficulty was the fact that sometimes this was being curtailed, and obviously we see why.
So, yeah, but I think this evening, was I right in saying that Dr. Hoolan said this evening that some of the restrictions that have been put in place by individual homes and places were not necessary at this time and should actually be lifted.
I accept that. And then there's also the point that fatigue could set in, as you said earlier. So, but people are definitely more accepting. Like, we talk about the St. Patrick's Day Parade and everybody welcomed that, but also everybody was seeing that happening for a couple of days. There was an element of we just needed it to happen. And the same is, I'm getting people coming to me in relation to even small gatherings or small meetings that, you know, people are organising. And like, obviously, we cancelled our own bigger meetings. And I think tomorrow night we're doing it a sort of live stream scenario at 7 o'clock rather than, you know, bringing a lot of people into a room with all the difficulties that arise in that. And you're somewhere between, it's a bit early possibly for cancelling something that, you know, might only have 5 or 10 people from a residence committee. But then when you're talking about 50 or 100 or 200, and even if it's outside, like, these things have to be considered. And I suppose there's an element, no more than St. Patrick's Day Parade, people are waiting until the decision is made at a top level, so then it comes down to them. So there, and also, nobody wants to jump ahead of the public health authorities.
Well, I just, a text I got in there, and I'll put this one to you, Mary Horgan. The problem with the by-the-book, evidence-based, wait-and-see approach is that by the time you have the evidence, it's too late. There's a lot to be said for a bit of preemptive action.
Yeah, I suppose there it's proactive versus reactive, and it's where that balance happens. Obviously, if we're more proactive, it would mean a lot of additional measures that would affect the population at large. But wouldn't it be great if Ireland was the exemplar for we're intervening, we have sorted this out, we haven't got to the stage where we need to have so many ventilators to put our patients on, and we would be the shining light of Europe, and that's what I'd like us to be.
Well, can I ask you a couple of questions, because we're getting very specific questions in about this, and you're the only one I can think of that could possibly have an answer for this. The people in such close proximity on public transport, is that likely to become an issue?
The data so far says 15 minutes in the presence in a very crowded situation. Of course, that can happen with our public transport. So I think the risk is still going to be low. When you get out, you use your hand sanitizers, you do all the appropriate things. And that's really probably been exposed to people who have, you know, coughs and sneezes when you're on board. And I haven't heard too much coughing in the situations I've been in recently.
Another one from Dr. Sarah O'Mahony here. Is there a plan to introduce a drive-through swab clinic in the Republic like they have in Antrim to prevent spread and keep patients in their homes? Do you know of any plans in relation to these kind of imaginative testing?
I don't know of any plans. I think it's a really good idea. I believe that they should be out away from big hospitals so that people, it's easy to access. But I don't know of any plans.
Bridget, are you still with us there?
Yes, I am indeed.
Just respond to that issue that Jack raised there a short while ago, that the EU response has been a little bit slow, and even the response today concentrating on the economic issues around this and things about flight slots and all that, and not the health of the citizens of the EU.
So firstly, I think this is both a public health issue, but it also has a very significant economic dimension. And if the European economies collectively tank, that will cause extraordinary disruption to all, to people's lives in terms of their jobs and their companies. So I think one can't say that one is unimportant. Secondly, it's really important to point out that public health is a national competence. The EU has very little capacity to intervene in health systems. And, for example, one could have argued that we should have, in Ireland's case, stopped all flights from northern Italy, because there's no doubt that was one of the transmission belts. But can you imagine the outcry in Ireland if all those young people who were skiing from Irish schools were left in northern Italy in the midst of a pandemic? So I think we really have to be realistic here. Now, I think what's beginning to happen in Brussels, and I saw that today in terms of there was a digital meeting across all the heads of government, that there will now be a fund to help countries. There will also be much more coordination. But I think this really comes down, so much of it will come down to local capacity, not just at national level, but also within our own communities, and how each and every one of us behaves, particularly those of us who may not be at high risk. So again, I think it's easy to say, yes, Brussels should have done more, but if public health is a national competence, then I need to be told what precisely it should have done, and I need to be told what the response would be if all those Irish people who were clearly skiing in northern Italy were left there.
Indeed. Can I just ask my panel again in relation to a couple of issues that are constantly being discussed, but we're no further closer to a decision on it. Schools and the possibility of closing schools. Where would you stand on that, Jack?
I think if the public health authorities say it's important to close schools, then schools will have to close. I think it's not a matter of politicians deciding one way or another if it's the right thing to do. And we're in the delay or mitigation phase, and it probably is going to happen at some stage. I think that has to be done, of course. Anything to protect public health and prevent it. It's spreading across the population.
Jack is a GAA player. Maybe he can tell us why intercounty games are not cancelled.
Again, I think that's why we need, I suppose, more guidelines on gatherings and on from the public health officials. And I think, you know, they are trying to strike that balance. But I think we're certainly heading in that direction. And you know, my fear is that, and I listened to Carmel Regan yesterday and Professor McCunkey, who are strong public health doctors in their own right, who are saying maybe we aren't, are we importing the knowledge from Italy? And the fact 2 weeks ago, I remember being on another programme and we were arguing over whether the match should have happened or not, and no one had died in Italy at that stage. So if you know, maybe we should be taking bigger measures, but it's for politicians to implement the decisions of the public health doctors in the Department of Health, who are very competent, and in fairness across party, there's been a collective response on that. It's not for politicians to start creating the decision-making framework around that.
Mary, you obviously have a very particular perspective on this, and you're not part of the public health team, but you have a very, you know, extensive expertise in it. Are there some decisions that you think hurry on and make them and move on to the next phase of this?
Well, as I said previously, the review of what's been happening, the one thing that has been effective has been social distancing. So, they need to make a decision on that, and whether it's all or phased in, I think the people are waiting for those decisions.
And when you say social distancing, what kind of restrictions would we be talking about then?
Well, there are many different types. We said about mass gatherings, that's been dealt with on with St. Patrick's Day, but there are other mass gatherings. There's whether schools should close, whether universities should close. And it should really be based on the evidence that's out there at the moment. And we know that there is evidence that social distancing is effective.
And again, when people are hearing mass gatherings, I mean, Rory, you mentioned it there, like there's people who have meetings that 20 people are likely to turn up to. Is that taking it too far to call that a mass gathering?
Well, it depends. If it's a bridge party of older people, you know, that's an example of something, or, you know, a choir. Does it need to happen? Probably not. Are they relieved when somebody cancels it? Absolutely. I had somebody, one of my patients today, saying his choir was cancelled. And I said, well, that's a great idea. So, you know, people on the ground are actually are doing, are being practical and are having that societal responsibility that Justine spoke about.
Rory.
Yeah, no, it's already been said. We basically need these guidelines to come down. Otherwise, you're going to have a continuation of ad hocery. And it's somewhere between I don't want to be seen as the guy that cancels this to I don't want to be seen as the person that puts this on and puts anyone in danger. Whereas people are willing at this stage and are in the right state of mind to follow instruction. And I'd agree also with what has been said in relation to the EU. It's like a lot of problems. Like, we have at this stage probably decent cross-border communication in relation to dealing with this problem, and that needs to be maintained and needs to continue.
And don't we need to look at this as an all-Ireland issue? Because we're going to be dealing with presumably quite limited resources and we should be pulling.
Inter-ministers, north and south, and the chief medical officers and their leading doctors, they're all meeting this week. And there is huge communication there. The other point is about social distancing. The National Transport Authority said that transport is down, numbers down about 5%. So people are aware, but people don't have a choice either. You know, and the other point I want to make about schools is that, like, you have national schools, obviously you have secondary schools, you have people doing exams, you have the Leaving Cert coming up, you have university cycle in terms of its calendar.
And you have, massive childcare issues.
If somebody's working, if you're working and your 6 or 7 year old child is at home, and you've nobody to look after them, so you have to give up your work.
And what happened?
So there's huge social issues there. Can I make one final point? It's the CMO, the chief medical officer, he has written to schools saying that they shouldn't, unless and until they give the word, you shouldn't close schools. Now, and I think the key point is we're all going along with the advice that he gives, I think, and that's what we have to do.
Yeah, Justine.
Social distancing, I think, raises questions about, you know, things that we take for granted, like going to the cinema, going to the theatre. Yeah. Bridget referred to how tactile Italian people are, and maybe that was a factor in the speedy transmission of the virus there. Well, what do we have in our culture? We have the Great Irish Pub, which heaves with people, you know, at 10 o'clock on a Friday night.
And you'd wonder how that old hand-washing thing goes after five pints as well.
And younger people may feel, you know, almost invincible because they're less affected by it. But they will be in the pubs, and then they go home and they pass it on.
St. Patrick's Day could still be a problem.
But can I say our young population have a great sense of social responsibility? I see it in the millennials. I see it in our young trainees. They actually take on board, and we've seen that with referenda recently. They do have social responsibility. A lot of them work in organisations that have corporate social responsibility. Yeah. So I think they actually get it.
You do. And also, when you see, even today, you can see the streets are much emptier. A lot of people are clearly working from home already. Yeah. This could transform how we operate as it dovetails extraordinarily well with the green agenda, actually, as it happens.
So I spoke with a colleague in the University of Toronto this afternoon, and he said that they looked into it, and 40% of their workers in Toronto can actually work from home. So, you know, it may be a change in how we do things, how we live our lives. It might be difficult, but, you know, sometimes change happens for a reason. Obviously, not with this major health issue, but, you know, people start being innovative in what they can do and how they live.
And not everyone can do that. You know, shops will still have to be shops where people go in to buy their groceries and all the rest of it, and you will still have human-to-human interaction.
And there's two other, I mean, obviously businesses. I mean, I saw a restaurant in the city centre this evening tweeting that they were closing because they had literally lost every single table booking they had. Mm. And this would be a very successful restaurant right in the city centre. So obviously there's a massive stress and anxiety for people who, you know, can't go a week without any bookings or without any customers coming into their shop. But also a huge issue at the moment must be the way we are living right now because of our housing crisis and the number of people who are sharing, you know, one house for three generations of a family. And to kind of blithely tell people, oh, go home and self-isolate, it's not going to work in those scenarios, is it?
Well, it would be challenging, and you've got maybe three generations living in the house with different needs, different medical needs, conditions. So that can be challenging, absolutely.
But the likelihood is the older people are going to are most at risk. And one of the issues I'm concerned about is the not that people shouldn't visit nursing homes, but to make sure that they have adequate and appropriate staff levels in all of those institutions. And I was on to HICWA about that earlier in the week, that I felt that, you know, I wanted to know, you know, were they changing their programme of visits in terms of inspections and so on? Because as I understand it, I think it's in Washington, a lot of the deaths have been in nursing homes as such. And it's just the concern, obviously, clearly, if you're, say, if you have shared bedrooms in nursing homes now, and there's not many perhaps that are in that situation, but how do you make sure that where all of our old people are, particularly with who are very unwell, and that's why they're in nursing homes, that they're safe and they're being protected? And that's not taking away from any of the fantastic homes or the fantastic staff that are there, but I think it needs significant, you know, I would like to know more about that personally.
No, all that would need to be addressed, but I think what you spoke about earlier was, here, there's an awful lot of people, like multi-generations, who are sharing homes. You're going to have shared bedrooms in situations like that. You're going to have very elderly people who fall into the percentage where this is going to be incredibly difficult.
And we have housing hubs, we have
all of the
hotels where there's whole families in rooms.
We have susceptibility down to the housing crisis that you mightn't have necessarily.
I just got a note in here. Nadine Doris, the health minister in the UK, has tested positive for COVID-19 and is self-isolating. I'm just thinking about all our ministers who are heading off. Is that a good idea in the current...
Well, I think the Taoiseach and I think the Taoiseach are definitely going. I know that Minister Humphreys is definitely not going. I think it's important...
Purely for the message we're sending out. I know we understand how important this is for Ireland Inc. every year, but... Yeah. In the current circumstances, when we are asking people not to travel to some places, is it a good idea for our cabinet to head
off? I think it's hugely important that the Taoiseach, notwithstanding what you're saying, he has truncated his visit, I think, to 2 days, that he will be meeting in the White House with the President and obviously key political leaders and Irish American communities in the United States. I think that's very important. I think it is appropriate that he would go, but obviously, clearly, in the conditions and in the way, you know, with your social, all of the criteria that should apply, must apply.
It might set a precedent for future years that you don't need this entire exodus of the cabinet, the cabinet all over the world. But you know what we forget sometimes is that government ministers are human beings as well. And I've seen a lot of commentary on social media recently about the St. Patrick's Day trips and people making out that they're junkets and how wonderful for them. I actually don't think I would like to be travelling at the moment for work, you know. It's not a very nice thing to have to do, to maybe fly to New York or Washington and come back home with the possibility that you might have been infected and that you're exposing your family to it.
Yeah, I'd agree. And I suppose one thing I fear is that, like, a lot of people are asymptomatic and they've this 14-day window and they can pass it on to someone else. And I fear that despite the best attempts of contact tracing, that really no one knows who's had it or interacted with someone. And if you look at the Chinese example, how they scaled up contact tracing was a huge way in how they restricted the spread of it. And I think we've 60 people at the moment in contact tracing, and I'm not sure how successful that will be.
They were talking about 5,000 or 6,000 was...
Yeah, can I just ask you, Mary, obviously you're president of the Royal College of Physicians, all those consultants out there on the front line, it's a big ask. They're facing into a very tough period of time. They all have family, you know, many of them have families themselves, and they're going to be right on the front line of this. So what kind of messages or extra training are they getting to deal with this?
So I absolutely agree. The frontline staff, I'm including doctors, nurses, other allied healthcare professionals, they're all in that category. So they would get trained up in personal protection. Every effort, protocols are in place to identify and isolate patients who may have suspected infection at a very early stage to contain it. But of course, they're at risk. And certainly the experience in China is that 4% of those infected were healthcare workers. And they go home to the families.
And what we're hearing, though, from Italy in particular, is that they're not going home to their families. And in China as well, they had protocols in place that they weren't going home because they were just too terrified that they would bring it back with them.
Well, that's a risk. And that's what we deal with in the front line, whether it's influenza, swine flu, SARS. That's life as a doctor and a healthcare professional in any country. But I can tell you, and having worked and spoken with my colleague in Cork today, how hard they're working. She left at 9:15 last night, making sure everybody was okay. And that's our job. We do it. It's stressful, but it's extremely rewarding.
Okay, I will leave that there. Professor Mary Horgan, we wish you and all of those staff, all those medical frontline workers out there, the absolute best in the days and weeks ahead. But there, we'll take a break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Well, I'm looking at this more.
And you're welcome. Sorry. You're welcome back. Now, negotiating teams from Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are due to start in-depth, detailed talks on government formation. Both parties issued statements saying that Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin held constructive discussions over the last 2 days about policy issues and the current political situation, and both parties will continue discussions with the Green Party. Fergus O'Dowd, does this mean that Fine Gael TDs will stop coming in here and telling us that they lost the election and to let the winners form a government?
We did lose votes and we did lose seats, and that's why we stood back for 5 weeks now.
Some might say that given the circumstances and what was coming at us like a train, as we can now see, the fact that you waited 31 days to stop sulking and start talking.
Well, that's one narrative. But the narrative I'm giving you are the facts. And the facts are that we did lose seats, we did lose votes, and clearly other parties.
And it took you 31 days to lick your wounds?
I can't even finish my sentence, please. I'd just like to make the point that we in Fine Gael said we'd leave it up to the other parties, that's Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil, and all of the other TDs, there's 127, to see if they could do it. And there's no sign of that. So having met with Micheál Martin on two occasions, now both leaders had an agreed statement that they are moving to a phase where they'll appoint teams.
Leo Varadkar obviously needs a mandate from the parliamentary party.
Yes.
He will get that, I presume, next week.
I would expect it absolutely next week. Absolutely, yes. But we still then have to go to a delegate conference after that.
That'll be if you get to a programme for government.
With this coronavirus, I don't know how you get around that issue. If you can't have an assembly,
that's an interesting one, actually.
It'd be same with Fianna Fáil or Sinn Féin.
You might have to have a postal ballot on it.
They could do it by email, and then they won't have any protests in the hall.
don't be giving them ideas, Justine.
Which party are you talking about there now?
All parties.
I mean, some might ask, is this the right time, Jack Chambers, to change horses, given we are, facing into what could be an unprecedented crisis? It'll take any new government time to bed in. Or should we be launching ourselves into government talks right now?
Well, it's not sustainable to have a caretaker government for weeks and months without any administration. I think we need to have detailed discussions and a programme for government now, and with the focus on housing and health and climate action, but also that we provide strong government, stable government for 5 years that actually delivers the change people expect. And we've been up for that from the very aftermath of the election.
Spent an election saying you would not under any circumstances put Fine Gael back into government.
We have a very fragmented Dáil, and we want to deliver the change people expect, but also deliver the, like, if you look at the economic figures, if you look at the fact that we're heading towards a global recession, Ireland needs to have a government in place with a majority to take the decisions necessary to improve people's lives, but also to manage this crisis, because we all know it's not going to go away, and we're up for that, and we want to match our responsibilities.
Okay, I don't want to cut across, but I do want to put you a thread that Eamon O'Keefe, your colleague, your Fianna Fáil colleague, has put on Twitter in the last hour. coronavirus, Ireland is not a mandate for long-term government. The current crisis must be dealt with radically and effectively. It does not allow for considered policy development across a wide range of areas, health, housing, climate change, over an extended horizon. And he said a national government set up for a short but defined period would be more effective during this post-election phase in terms of taking potentially drastic measures that will be required in the short term by building consensus and depoliticising the crisis.
I don't agree. I think we need a strong, stable government quickly. That, and in fairness,
how quick do you think we could do this?
I've been involved in the negotiations with the Greens. I had the bilateral discussion with Fine Gael. We're in very detailed policy discussions on housing, on health, and climate action, and there we need action on those as well. So, you know, having a short-term national government doesn't resolve the general issue we have, which is that we have no government, permanent government in place, and we need to see a five-year programme developed that focuses on the policy that Eamon refers to. But I don't think a national government solves the issue. We need a government that people can know will last for a period of time so that the decisions he references can be actually taken.
Rory Amorico.
All right, well, here, housing, health, pensions. People voted for change. Obviously, I don't think they voted for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to go in together. It looks like they're doing it. There was probably a belief out there that this was going to happen. There is even a train of thought out there in relation to that, similar to what Eamon O'Keefe seems to have inferred, that this gives an element of cover. Now, we obviously have talked to everyone from a point of view of putting a programme for government together and putting in what people looked for. And we've talked to the Social Democrats, we've talked to the Greens, we've talked to the Independents. I think everyone's aware of who wouldn't talk to us. And obviously they've changed their tone in the last while because they realised this wasn't particularly popular. And yes, we need to deal with this COVID-19 situation. And that does mean cross-party agreement, and it also means taking a line and taking a lead from public health authorities. And again, I would call for guidelines to come down so we can ensure that the wider populace is aware of what exactly they need to do, and I think they're prepared for that. But I'm not sure that the wider populace is at this point in time looking for what these guys are talking about, but they're obviously very, very comfortable and they have no difficulty in doing this. And
I don't know,
that's not
would
true,
you have no difficulty in doing it? I'll ask Justine this one. I mean, this is, if we strip away COVID-19 and the Dáil mats and everything, it is an extraordinary moment in Irish political history that we are seriously now, looks like, on the brink of the old enemies coming together.
Absolutely. I mean, it doesn't seem so long ago since the very idea of Fianna Fáil going into coalition with anybody was unimaginable, and they broke that record by going in with the PDs. I think COVID-19 is a good reason for forming a government. It's also going to give them the cover for doing it. And it will allow the leaders to sell it to their special delegate conferences or Deshna. I saw where Leo Varadkar, in his email to his parliamentary party today, actually used the term standing by the Republic, which has a very strong resonance in Irish history. It has to be a government that's going to last for a number of years, and I think that will have to be part of the agreement. Now, there is, when the Dáil met last week, it agreed that when it meets again on Thursday of next week, there will be a vote on nominations for Taoiseach. Is it possible to do it in that space of time? Well, I think anything is possible, but I think it's highly unlikely because you've got three elements to this. You've Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Greens, who also have to go to a special conference and
possibly
get two-thirds.
Rural independents as well, who are still in the mix,
well,
aren't they?
Yeah.
And of course, we know the Greens have to get two-thirds majority, which is a much higher hurdle. Could we have it by Thursday? I mean, I'm very conscious that we're entering, again, unprecedented territory here
in terms
of
it's a matter, obviously, the teams will be appointed and they'll discuss things. Our party meeting, I presume, at this moment. We don't have a date. I presume it will be Thursday. So, I mean, I don't see any reason why we wouldn't agree with the, you know, with a mandate.
Sorry, but you're saying you won't even have another parliamentary party meeting?
No, what I said was I don't have a date for it as I speak to you. Normally, we would meet on the Wednesday, but the Dáil isn't sitting next Wednesday, so it's up to the... The key point is this, that we will meet next Wednesday. We will give the go-ahead to the negotiations, but I don't think you'll have a programme for government that quickly. And it has to be robust. If it works, it has to be robust. It has to be challengeable. You know, I mean, if there are people in each party who mightn't like it, you know, you'll have to give space to them as well. And you have to have that debate as well. But I think at the end of the day, what you want is a government that does all the things that the people want and at the same time rewards enterprise and encourages people, you know, to go into business, and that we don't tax people too much. But at the same time, looked after poor people, housing, health, all those issues have to be done.
Good luck. Yeah. All of that, Fergus O'Dowd,
well, that's what
with
government
the
has
3
to do.
Billion today being pledged, or that we're now pledging on just the initial stages of this.
Of course,
That 11 billion that we were frittering away so fantastically during the campaign, those promises are gone out the window.
But, no, of course they are, but the 3 billion, I think there's about 2 billion of that actually came from the money that the government kept that it didn't spend and didn't give away in the budget last year, the rainy day fund and the money which was there for Brexit. So the fact is that, you know, that's what a government has to do. It can't get rid of property tax. It can't introduce new taxes that Sinn Féin wanted. And that's why I think that there's
why
more...
Why can't it introduce new taxes?
Well, because we don't have the economy is going into, more than likely going into recession. Less people are going to be working. It's going to be, the tax base isn't going to be there the way that it was. And that's why you need like minds, and there are lots of differences between Fianna Fáil and lots of similarities.
We still need to get through this situation, and the reality is we still need to build houses, because we're dealing with complete disasters across the board. Now, do I think that these two parties are going to sit together and come up with something perfect that people want?
We're very clear. We've met the Land Development Agency. We've met a lot of... We want to absolutely front up on our responsibilities on housing policy, and that means radical change that goes beyond what many of us have said in terms of public and affordable housing. What's interesting is...
You've had a conversation with the Land Development Agency.
Owen O'Brien, you know, was tweeting in the last 24 hours about his disgust that councillors from other parties approved 500 houses, 400 of which are social and affordable. So Sinn Féin wants the perfect...
We are out of time.
We will have this debate again, but we have to leave it there. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Nicky Dempsey was on sound. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank my panel, and I want to hand you over now to Colm Murray on Late Date.